बुद्धं शरणं गच्छामि।
हेलो एवरीवन, वेलकम बैक टू रियल्म ऑफ राइनो। माय नेम इज प्रिंस एंड इन दिस एपिसोड आई वांटेड टू डिस्कस एंड शेयर अबाउट बुद्धिज्म इन इटली, especially about my own personal experience, what it has been like living and practicing with the forest monks at the monastery. So I think this would be a good, interesting topic to dive into, especially for lay people, you know, how the ideal way to practice as a lay practitioner. Before that, I wanted to express my thanks and gratitude to everyone who listened to the first podcast. I received lots of positive feedback and support from lots of people. So thank you for your kindness. And so let's begin probably, you know, with the history of Buddhism in Italy. I think that would be a good overview. And then we can dive into like my own experience. So Buddhism in Italy, it's not actually a new religion, as it might seem to a lot of people. Currently, it's the third most practiced religion in Italy. As per recent data, there are about 160,000 Buddhists in Italy. So the reason I said why it's not a new religion, because if we go back into time in ancient Rome, according to some sources, you know, Buddhism might have been practiced even though marginally in ancient Rome, as we have some archaeological artifacts, you know, that validates the fact that Buddhism might have been practiced in Italy. Also, if we look at Buddhism, history of Buddhism in India, how the Greeks had an influence on the artistic aspect of Buddhism in India. So there are a lot of sources that suggest, you know, that Buddhism was practiced in Italy before, like, you know, Christianity came the main practicing religion here. So the contemporary Buddhist presence in Italy started around 1960s. So it's relatively new. In 1960, there was founded the Associazione Buddhista Italiana, Buddhist Italian Association. And then from 1980s to 1989, there was started a foundation to preserve the Mahayana tradition in Italy from the Vajrayana practitioners, from the Vajrayana sect of Buddhism. Then there is currently a Buddhist Union, Italian Buddhist Union, known as UBI, which was founded in 1985. Italian Buddhist Union is basically an organization that caters to help unite all the various Buddhist traditions in Italy. So currently in Italy, actually, you can find pretty much all different types of Buddhist schools, from Theravada to Vajrayana, Mahayana, Zen, Nichiren, Sion, and even some form of Tantric, Tiantai Buddhism. So the UBI is acknowledged as an association that coordinates the 44 principal centers in Italy from all these major three schools, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. Between the most important Buddhist centers in Italy, there is the Soto Zen Center in Rome. And then you have Santa Chitarama, the Thai Forest Monastery. That's where I stayed, and I'll be talking about that later on. And then you have another Zen center, Zen Buddhist Monastery, called Ensoji Il Cerchio, in the area of Milan. Milan is actually the city where you can find, like, it's a city populated with most Buddhist temples. I've heard that Milan has even more Buddhist temples than New York City. And I've been to Milan many times. There are mostly Buddhist practitioners from Sri Lanka and Thailand there. So that's pretty much about how the state of Buddhism in Italy in 2024. So let me maybe start with how I came into touch with Buddhism in Italy and my own personal interaction. So after coronavirus, I was looking into to learn about or visiting Buddhist temples in Italy, but during Corona, everything was closed. So I started searching up online Buddhist temples near my area. I live in the north of Italy, so you don't have a lot of Buddhist centers near my area. You have to actually travel quite a bit. And the closest Buddhist temple that I found was in the mountains area. That's about 2.5 hours from my home. So I decided to go there in 2020, in winter 2020, with my parents. So we visited that temple, and that is a temple called Tenryuzanji. The monk who resides there, he's ordained in both Theravada and Mahayana, which is quite interesting because in the beginning I was very unsure which school to pursue as I was still learning about Buddhism, so I didn't know what is the best practice, whether I should be following Mahayana or Theravada. You have all these different types of teachings, so I think it's natural as a beginner to get lost. So I was just trying to find my way out. So that was actually my first visit to a Buddhist temple in Italy at Tenryuzanji in 2020. And when we reached there, the monk welcomed us. So we told him, we are visiting for the first time. And he was very kind, very gentle, and he had a chat with us, And then he gave us some teachings from Dhammapada. I asked him some questions about Mahayana and Theravada. So when he told me that he is ordained in both traditions, from Tiantai in Japan and Theravada in Sri Lanka, I asked him whether this is not a contradiction, and he said, "No, it's totally okay. Like, you can be, or if you want, you can get ordained in both traditions." So he basically follows Theravada Vinaya as well as the Mahayana Bodhisattva vows. And I asked him, so I was trying to figure out which is the best practice for me. So I asked him which Mahayana sutras I should be reading. So he asked me, "Did you read the Pali Canon?" I told him here and there, just a little bit. So his advice to me was that you should first read Pali Canon. You should build a solid foundation on the Pali Sutta Pitaka. And after that, you can dive into the Mahayana Sutras because Mahayana Sutras are very profound teachings. So as a beginner, it's not usually advised to someone to dive into Mahayana teachings directly. First, it's important to understand the fundamental teachings of Buddhism, like the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Three Marks of Existence. So once you get a basic understanding, then you can dive into Mahayana Sutras. But still, you have to be careful to find the correct translations because I have observed lots of Mahayana Sutras are often simplified or overcomplicated. So you have to be very careful. Probably best to study under the guidance of a well-trained monk. So that's how my practice began. So I started then, with the reading the Theravada Canon. And after that, I did a retreat at Amalfi Coast in summer 2021, where there were visiting monks from Thailand and USA. And I saw this opportunity, that they were visiting in Italy. So I took some days off from work and I decided to join that retreat at Amalfi Coast. You know, I thought that would be, good, interesting experience to practice Dhamma at Amalfi Coast. So I went there over a weekend, and where I met these Thai monks and Aya Soma, who is an Italian bhikkhuni currently residing at Empty Cloud Monastery in USA, but now they are doing a lot of work in Italy to build a monastery in Puglia in Italy for the ordination of bhikkhunis, and also to provide a center for practice and study of Buddhism. So there is a lot of work going on actually in Italy, as you know, as far as Buddhism is concerned. So that retreat was my first exposure into the Buddhist practice. And during that retreat, I remember waking up early in the morning around 4:30, and then we had meditation session at the beach. So we would be going to the beach and meditating there early in the morning for about 30 minutes. You know, it was so peaceful because in the morning, like, you have less crowd since Amalfi is a very busy tourist spot. So morning, sitting on the beach, it was so calm, serene. And then would be going for a walk with the venerable Thai monks. So that few days at Amalfi Coast was very wonderful. And then I had a chat with Aya Soma and Pante Sudaso. I had, some questions, doubts about Buddhism. So they cleared out me, and then Aya Soma pointed to me about Santa Chitarama. So she told me, so I heard about Santa Chitarama first about from Aya Soma, and she said you should visit Santa Chitarama if you want to deepen your practice and understanding. It's a wonderful place where lay practitioners can go and practice under the guidance of monks. So after that, in 2022, summer 2022, I decided to visit Santa Chitarama. So I had a week off from work, so I decided to book my stay at Santa Chitarama. So Santa Chitarama is the name of Italian Theravada Buddhist monastery from the Thai forest lineage of Ajahn Chah. It's located near Rome. It's actually an hour from Rome. It's not exactly in Rome. There is a city called Rieti. It's an hour in bus from Rome, and then you have to walk from about 20 to 25 minutes, and then you reach Santa Chitarama. So I first visited Santa Chitarama in August 2022, then in December 2022, January 2023. So I stayed there two times. My first visit in summer 2022 was my first experience living at the monastery and following the eight precepts. I remember I reached on full moon day. So during full moon day, there's a tradition in Theravada to basically meditate until midnight, from 7 p.m. till midnight. So before that, I had never sat in meditation for such a long time. Like, my maximum sitting time would be about 30 minutes. That was my would be my first chance to sit in meditation for such a long. So I remember when I reached there, the one of the senior monks, Ajahn Mahapanyo, he said, "Oh, you came on the right time, on right day. It's your first visit, so welcome to practice with us, for on full moon day." So that was like the first challenge, I would say. But thing is, like, you don't have to sit straight from 7 p.m. to 12 until midnight, So you sit about 45 minutes, in one sitting, and then you can go do like a walking meditation. Then you can come back for sit another half an hour. Then you can again go for walking meditation. So you can change your posture. You don't have to sit for 4 hours straight, but you can like manage your meditation practice. And I was surprised actually. I managed to sit for such a long time. I tried to sit for as long as I could. When I was really having pain, then I stood out and then went to do like a walking meditation. But I didn't find it that challenging, as I was expecting. And then I can maybe tell you a little bit about the schedule, what it is like, the schedule of at the monastery. So first of all, the stay at the monastery is free of charge, although donations are appreciated to help in running costs. So you book your request online, and then based on the availability, they give you the slot where you can go and live at the monastery. So usually 1 week is requested minimum if you want to stay at the monastery. 1 week minimum is required. Otherwise, you can visit daily, on your own at any time. So the daily routine varies, from tradition to tradition, but typical day follows like you wake up at 4:30 a.m. Then you get ready, take a shower. Then there is morning chanting at 5 a.m., followed by meditation. So we do like Pali chanting at 5 a.m., about 15 minutes, and then 45 minutes meditation, sitting meditation. So basically from 5 to 6:15 a.m. And then at 6:30, there are some duties assigned to basically prepare breakfast or clean, do some cleaning, domestic chores. And then 7 a.m., breakfast is served. So first, like the monks go take their meal, and then the anagarikas, and then those who were preparing the meal, breakfast, and then the rest of the practitioners, they can go. So then after finishing breakfast, at 8 a.m. you have work meeting where they assign you different work roles. So I remember I was assigned a couple of times going into the forest to help out cut the bamboo trees. So basically we were cutting these bamboo trees because there was one of the monks who was building a wall of these bamboo trees near his kuti. So I was assigned to help him out to cut these bamboos from the forest and then help out to put these bamboos to create a wall around his kuti. So then from 8 to basically 10:30, you have this your work time, so every person is assigned a duty. Some do in the kitchen prepare for lunch, some work in the forest, or some clean the hall in the monastery. So different duties are assigned to different people. And then at 11 a.m. you have the main meal. The Theravada monastic tradition follows, not eating after midday. So after midday, no meal is like provided. So you finish your food before 12 p.m. and then after that you help with the cleaning and washing up the dishes. And at 12:30 p.m. then there's a time for like individual meditation or study. So afternoon you have pretty much free time from 1 p.m. to like 5 p.m. You can just like visit the monastery, take a walk, go to the library, read a book, or just go to your room, take some rest, or meditate on your own. Then at 5 p.m. you have a tea break, followed by a Q&A with one of the senior monks. So you have 1 hour Q&A session where you can ask questions, any doubts you might have. Then at 7:30 you have evening chanting followed by meditation. So you do like 15 minutes evening chanting and then 40 to 45 minutes sitting meditation. And then at 9 p.m. everyone goes to their rooms and go to sleep. So you're going to wake up again 4:30 a.m. So this is pretty much what the schedule looks like at the monastery. And of course you have to follow the 8 precepts. So apart from those classical five precepts, additional, three precepts that you don't eat after midday, you don't do any sort of entertainments, you don't sleep on luxurious bed. So you have to restrain your senses, constantly observe your mind, live in solitude, cultivate contentment through the practice. So I remember this was my first time practicing eight precepts, and even here I was surprised that it wasn't that challenging for me. I was actually in the beginning worried, thinking, oh, will I be able to, follow the eight precepts, especially regarding eating after, not eating after noon. But I think it really has to do about the environment at the monastery, because everyone is following the same schedule and the environment is built in such a way that your mind doesn't even think about food or doesn't even go there. You are in constantly aligned with your practice. You are surrounded by these practitioners, monks. So that kind of energy builds up, So you don't even think about pursuing your desires, going after food or sensual pleasures. Your mind naturally becomes detached from those things. So it wasn't that challenging, not eating after midday. I know a lot of people, when I told this to my colleagues at work, they were like, oh, how could you not eat after midday, man? That's really unrealistic. So I told them it's really how the entire schedule is designed, because after midday, you don't do any hard work or hard labor. All the work about the monastery, cleaning, it's done in the morning between 8 a.m., 11 a.m. After that, in the afternoon, you don't do anything that consumes your energy. So if you don't do any hard physical labor or any work that consumes your energy, so you are preserving your energy, and of course on top of that you're meditating, so that aids to that. So it's not that hard, it might seem, but I think at home it's a different scenario. If you have to follow these eight precepts at home, I think it's way harder. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but it's way harder because you have so many barriers, distractions coming up one after another. So you don't have such an environment to practice correctly. You might be able to do it for 1 or 2 days, but after that, something comes up. And plus, of course, you are working as well, so you need to eat to maintain yourself. So that's why Buddha said that the house life or lay life is a dusty path, because it's very hard to practice the Dhamma at home. Of course, five precepts are the minimum requirements. So lay practitioners, I think, should be at least without breaking, they should adhere to the five precepts strictly, not blindly, but they should have a solid faith in the five precepts, and probably then try to do Uposatha practice at least once a month on full moon day, where you observe the eight precepts. So that's doable at home. But then maybe once in a year, you can visit a monastery and you can stay there for a week where you observe the eight precepts, and then, live in the monastic tradition, with the monks. So that can really help you with your practice. So I remember in the evening or in the afternoon, when I would have a free time, I would go take a walk in the forest. And one time I sat in the forest, a thought appeared in my mind. I told to myself, as I am deepening my practice, I realized how precious this experience is. I experienced a sense of calm, peacefulness, as if all the worries have disappeared. Like nothing would come into my mind, that I need to pursue something. Everything was just pure stillness. So I was sitting on this wooden bench by the lake in the forest, listening to the sounds of the birds, the flow of the water, the light breeze, rejoicing the solitude in seclusion to still and purify mind from the defilements. And I told to myself, if I could I would give up all the worldly pleasures to just sit here in solitude and dedicate the rest of my life to the noble Dhamma of Buddha. Yeah, I can recall that moment. I think it was a very precious moment for me. There is something in the forest or in seclusion, like nobody is there to bother you. I think that is the best moment for you to contemplate as well. You can observe all your kilesas, defilements, clearly, you know. So definitely living at the monastery, I think, really helped me to realize deeper aspects of the Dhamma. And one time I was helping out monks. One of the senior monks is from Thailand. His name is Ajahn Go. And then there was one young monk from Slovenia, I think. So we were preparing tents for the guests at the monastery. So, you know, a lot of people usually have this misconception that monks at the monastery, all they do is just meditation. They just meditate whole time. They don't do anything at all, or they don't do anything else. But that's not true. You know, if you go to a monastery, you will see that monks do everything there by themselves. Of course, they follow their own precepts. They have their dedicated time for meditation, chanting. But apart from that, they have the responsibility also to take care of the monastery, to take care of the guests, to teach them the Dhamma, you know. And all the repairing work, cleaning activities, it's not only relied on the lay people. I mean, a lot of monks engage in those as well. So I saw Ajahn Go, he was very dedicated, and he's very talented as well. You know, I learned a lot of things from him. He was constantly working, doing one thing and after another, you know. So yeah, like, it's not that monks just meditate and that's it. I think the best way to see the Dhamma, you really have to I think it's a good idea to visit a monastery, because a lot of people have their own misconceptions about what monks do or what their practice is like, you know. So they make up ideas in their own mind which might be far away from the reality. So another thing I found very interesting is seeing these young Italian monks practicing 2,500 years old Eastern tradition. Because all of the monks at the monastery, they were either from Thailand, Italian, or this one senior monk, the abbot of the monastery, Venerable Ajahn Chantapalo, who was ordained by Ajahn Sumedho. He is the current abbot of the monastery. He's not Italian. I think he's from England, but he lives in Italy, and he has been living at the monastery for the past many years with the duty to spread the Dhamma in Italy. But rest of all the young monks, they are actually Italian. So I was very surprised to see this. So, you know, like, how could these young Italian fellows, you know, why would they pick up a tradition which is so far away from their culture? But then there's another thing. As one, you know, the monk at the Tenryu Zanji monastery, he had told me that there are no coincidence in life. Like, nothing happens out of a coincidence. So even these young monks, the Italian, who embraced Buddha's Dhamma, it is not out of a coincidence. It's because of their past paramitas, merits and virtues that they have, you know. Because it's not an easy path to follow the monastic tradition, or at least it might seem a bit strange, you know. And that like stood out to me, because if I see monks from India or Thailand or other Asian countries, those don't come out as a stranger, because Buddhism is well spread in those countries. But Italy, being mostly like a Christianity Catholic country, so you are seeing these young monks practicing Buddhism, chanting, learning Pali, following the Vinaya, and also to seeing their dedication towards the Dhamma. That was also very inspiring. I had a chat on one with one of these young monks. I was very surprised to see how fluent he was in Pali language, as well as his understanding about Buddha's Dhamma. So at that moment, I had reflected, I wish to see this thing one day in India. But then I realized, I feel like the future of Buddhism or the monastic tradition is on the West. As long as Dhamma is not manipulated or misused, but you can find a lot of sincere practitioners from the West. Like in the current modern times, I think we are living in a very wonderful time, where we have so many dedicated young fellows who are taking up the robes, And then you have so many these senior monks who were trained and ordained under Venerable Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Mahabua, Ajahn Mahaban. So we have very senior disciples with us currently. So it's not a small thing, to have such wonderful, noble disciples who are with us to teach us the Dhamma and to guide us in the right path as well. So yeah, I also feel like anyone's encounter with Buddha's teachings is not a mere coincidence. It has to do with one's past karmic merits as well. Because as Buddha said, in after when he was a bit reluctant to teach the Dhamma, when Brahma Sampati came down from heavenly realm to request the Buddhas to teach the Dhamma, Buddha was very worried that these people are lost in ignorance. They are soaked up in pleasures, ignorance. This Dhamma, which is so subtle, so fine, so deep, it's very hard to realize and understand. But then there will be some people who have less dust in their eyes, who have right view, and with practice and right guidance, they can break the shell of ignorance. And we can see that happening even after 2500 years. Even though Buddha's Dhamma has been kind of disappeared from India, but it spread to all these different countries from where millions of people have benefited over the past thousands of years, from China to Japan to Korea to Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and now even in Europe. Currently, it's spreading and growing in Europe as well. So it's wonderful to see this, that even after so many years, you have sincere practitioners who have understanding and faith in the triple jewels. Yeah, so I think I would highly recommend to anyone who wish to kind of deepen their practice to at least visit a monastery, in their country, and spend time with monks to practice them life at the monastery. It can be really helpful and will bring also a lot of deep realizations in the practice as well. But it doesn't mean that if we are at home that we can't practice, or we shouldn't practice, or we should or use this as an excuse. As I mentioned, that lay practitioners, they should definitely take up the five precepts and then do their daily chanting and daily meditation, whether it's 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever time you can dedicate, and then try to provide support for the monks and temples and monasteries, So we have to practice the threefold practice: dana, sila, bhavana. So dana, to cultivate generosity, and then sila, the precepts, and bhavana, meditation. So we can definitely do that. And I was reading currently about the Sotapatti Samyutta, about the fruits of stream entry, which is achievable and can be realized by the lay practitioners or in the household life. You know, so a Sotapanna, once a person has reached stream entry, then they can reach Nibbana within 7 lives. So it's definitely doable. As my Zen master from Korea usually says, that we don't meditate to seek something out of it, or we don't sit in meditation to calm our mind or to seek enlightenment. Because if you're going with a desire, then you will be disappointed, because most of the times you will realize cultivating a peaceful state during meditation, it's not that easy. Most of the time you are struggling with the inner demons, inner fires, kilesas. So you will just sit in meditation and observe with mindfulness whatever is happening in your mind, what thoughts are appearing. So you become aware of all the sensation of going on in your body. So you constantly just focus on your breathing, but you don't sit up with an intention. The relaxed state or the cultivation of samatha and vipassana, those will arise naturally out of practice. But if you sit with an intention or desire, then you will run away from reaching those states. Or you shouldn't even sit with the state, you know, that I want to reach a jhana or meditative concentrative states. If you do go with that intention, that is actually a barrier in itself. So you just sit as your duty, because we have faith and confidence in the teachings of the Buddha, that the path that Buddha laid out for us, it has value, it is beneficial, it is the medicine to cure all suffering. And then over time, with the gradual training and practice, we will be able to see the fruits of practice, and our minds will naturally slowly become calmer. We will be able to see everything clearly and become disenchanted with the world and cultivate mindfulness and peace of mind. Those are natural states that will arise by themselves. So I think that's about it. Probably, you know, I can keep talking probably for another hour, but I don't want to take this podcast too long, because the last one went for about 2 hours. So I think I'll stop here. Maybe in the next episodes we can cover more topics. And if you have any questions, you can feel free to ask and reach out to me, and I'll be happy to answer. And I hope this episode was valuable and helpful for you. And thank you again for listening, for dedicating your time. I wish you all a wonderful day. May you all be well, happy, and healthy.
Good job.